Hello everyone, and welcome to the Conquerors Podcast, episode 4.2, Ahmose, the Liberator. Last episode, we talked about the history of ancient Egypt, from the days of early human settlement to the reign of Seqnen Ra'taha, king of the 17th dynasty. One important point I'll mention here is that by the time of the 17th dynasty, the chief deity of the Egyptian pantheon, to whom the kings attributed all their power and were his representatives, was Amun-Ra. Although Seqnen-Ra'ta's reign was short and not well documented, it was notable for the War of Liberation which he launched against the foreign Hyksos in the north. That war and the expulsion of the Hyksos would go on to become a family obsession, stretching for most of his reign and his two sons' reigns. I'll describe first the geopolitical situation in Egypt at this point. To the north, Lower Egypt was under the direct control of the Hyksos, while Upper Egypt was mostly under the Theban 17th dynasty's control. The area between the two, the so-called Middle Egypt, was composed of small city-states, mostly loyal to the Hyksos. To the south, a new power had emerged, the Kingdom of Kush. The people of this kingdom were the Nubians. After hundreds of years of influence and in some areas direct control by the Egyptians, their culture was influenced a lot by their Egyptian neighbors. A power on their own now, they established their own kingdom, in the process occupying several forts built by the Egyptians, an act of outright insult for many Egyptians. From the sources available to us, it seems that early on in his reign, Seqnen-Ra declared war on the Hyksos and launched many raids against them and personally led his forces. Although merely raids at this point, with little permanent conquest, the fact that the Egyptians were now on the offensive signaled a shift in the balance of power. The strategy Seqnen-Ra implemented during these raids was one that his sons would also go on to use and which I will describe. The Thebans would attack on two fronts, with the land army being commanded by the king, while the Theban navy sailed up the Nile, serving primarily as an assault force and not, as one would expect, for carrying supplies. As from the sources available to us, it seems that the Egyptian army mostly lived off the land. Very bad news for the locals. The reason Seqnen-Ra wasn't able to convert any of these raids to permanent conquests was probably his early and very violent death, most probably in one of these raids, after a reign lasting at most 5 years. His mummy was found with several gruesome wounds on his head and neck. As Eugene Gribaud, the Egyptologist who uncovered the mummy, concluded very graphically, "A blow from an axe must have severed part of his left cheek, exposed his teeth, fractured the jaw, and sent him senseless to the ground. Another blow must have seriously injured the skull, and a dagger or a javelin has cut open the forehead on the right side, a little above the eye. His body must have remained lying where it fell for some time. When found, decomposition had set in, and the embalming had to be hastily performed as best as it might." And indeed, amongst the royal mummies found, his was one of the worst preserved. One theory even suggests that Seqnen-Ra was executed by the Hyksos. And if true, it seems that the execution didn't go so smoothly. His death, and the sacrilegious treatment of his body, would only make his son and heir Kamose, and more importantly, his sister wife, Iyahotep, even more determined to defeat the Hyksos. Add the death of Seqnen-Ra the Brave, and due to Kamose's young age and inexperience, his mother acted as a regent until her son was ready. Not an easy task for any regent, even more for a woman. But Iyahotep would prove to be as capable as her husband and her two sons, holding the kingdom together at a potentially dangerous moment when its king died in battle, and ensuring the survival of their dynasty. She even managed to expand the kingdom a bit until her son was ready to take the throne. An obviously energetic ruler, Kamose resumed the war with the Hyksos as soon as he took the throne, turning his father's raid into a full-scale invasion. Inscriptions dating to his reign were found that established another aspect of this war that may have already existed, but now seemed to have become state propaganda, later to be embraced by Ahmose. That the Hyksos were foreigners, Asiatic invaders who defiled the Holy Land of Egypt, and must be vanquished. We don't have a lot of information about Kamosi's campaigns in the north. He continued his father's strategy of a two-front assault by both land and river. Some sources even claim that he attacked Avaris itself, though that seems to be an exaggeration. Fun fact, to all of you who have watched the first two films of the Mummy series, during Kamosi's campaigns, we get the first mention of widespread use of units composed of a people the Egyptians called the Magi. Magi was a term used by the Egyptians for all the nomadic peoples that inhabited the desert border between Upper Egypt and Nubia. In Kamosi's campaigns, they were widely used as forward troops for either scouting or hit-and-run attacks. During the New Kingdom, the term Magi would evolve and would be used to describe an elite unit of the Egyptian Empire that included native Egyptians as well. Two steles dating to Kamosi's reign describe the campaign against the Hyksos and their vassals. Many towns on the Nile and in the desert oases were captured. Two towns, Nifrosi and Aftih, are mentioned specifically falling to his armies. The Battle of Nifrosi is notable because it is the first time that the use of chariots in ancient Egypt is described. If we are to believe the inscriptions on the steles, no doubt influenced by Kamosi's propaganda, the Hyksos became so worried that they sent messengers to the king of Kush, suggesting an alliance and mutual attack against Kamosi. But Kamosi was able to capture these messengers, preventing a two-front attack against his kingdom. By the end of this first campaign, Kamosi had expanded his kingdom, pushing back the Hyksos' influence while replacing their vassals with his own, putting the Thebans firmly on the offensive. Kamosi's greatest achievement was perhaps psychological, as he proved that the Hyksos were not invincible and could be defeated by the Egyptians. I have no doubt that Kamosi's intention was to push north to the gates of Avaris itself and avenge his father. He wouldn't get the chance, however, as soon afterwards he died. Although assassination is the first cause of death that comes to mind, we can't tell for sure. Although we know that Kamosi's mummy survived and was definitely found sometime during the end of the 19th century, it wasn't identified and was lost, so we didn't get the chance to look for clues for how he died. Although his reign also didn't last for more than 5 years, it was definitely a successful and monumental one. With Kamosi's death, responsibility fell once more on Iyahutep to act as regent for her 10-year-old son, Ahmose. This regency was even more dangerous, as Kamosi, the original heir of her husband, didn't have any known heirs, and her second son was still young, seemingly even younger than Kamosi was when their father died. Still, Iyahutep proved her great character and abilities once more, ruling the kingdom successfully until Ahmose was ready. The greatest evidence for this success is the fact that we don't have any source mentioning the Hyksos trying to reverse the Theban gains during this period. And despite this consolidation of power, Iyahutep allowed her two sons to assume the throne. We shouldn't take this for granted, as the next ruling queen who was able to consolidate power, the more famous Hatshepsut, didn't give up that power until, well, she died. Now, we finally come to this episode's great conqueror himself, Ahmose the Liberator. I'll start with his name. Ahmose means Child of Ea, or the Moon. We don't know a lot about Ahmose's childhood. Being that he wasn't the eldest son didn't help in that matter. He was probably born around 1560 BC. To the standard upbringing of any Theban prince, one can add the influence of his mother and the circumstances in which he grew up. One can easily imagine the young Ahmose being groomed by his mother to continue his father and his brother's war. His sister and later grandwife was Ahmose Nefertari, who may have also been Kamos's wife, yet no records mentioning this exist. Although he was only 10 years old when he took the throne, it doesn't seem to have been an unusual age. In a time in which the average life expectancy was around 32, a 10-year-old king was actually pretty normal. Let's not for a second underestimate the challenges that Ahmose had to face. The Hyksos were a weakened yet still formidable foe. The Nubians to the south were still hostile. For many in his own kingdom, he was still this kid under the sway of his obviously powerful mother. Another very important aspect that in our modern times is forgotten is the religious one. Ahmose's two predecessors, whose main pursuit was the war against the Hyksos, had died after very short reigns. How could kings, claiming to be the representatives of the god Amun-Ra, die this way? No doubt that many people, especially the anti-war faction in Thebes, wondered if that was a sign of displeasure from the gods. But Ahmose had a destiny to fulfill, and if he wanted war, he had to prepare for it. And prepare he did. One reason for the success of the Hyksos was their superior weaponry compared to the Egyptians at the time of their arrival. They introduced the horse and the chariot to Egypt. They used the composite bow, far superior to the simple Egyptian bow, and had better armor and battle axes. If the Egyptians were to beat them, they had to learn and even surpass them. This process had already begun by previous rulers of the 17th dynasty, but seems to have intensified under Iyahutep and Ahmose. The composite bow was adopted, better bronze production and working methods were introduced, Theban soldiers began to wear body armor, and the chariot was adopted by the Theban army with some modifications and upgrades. By the time he was around 20, Ahmose had been king of Thebes and Upper Egypt for more than a decade. He now had a well-trained army, with many veterans of his father and his brother's campaigns, equipped with the finest weapons of its day, and a clear target, Avaris. He also didn't have to worry about discontent at court, as his mother would remain at Thebes to rule in his stead. As incredible as it sounds, we actually have what we would today call an autobiography of a soldier who fought under Ahmose that gives us a first-hand account of the king's campaigns. This autobiography has survived in the form of inscriptions on the walls of the tomb of a man called Ahmose, son of Ibana, or Ahmose Ibana. He was the son of an officer who fought in Seqnan Ra's campaigns and would himself go on to serve with distinction under Ahmose and his two successors, Amenhotep I and Thutmose I, in campaigns stretching from Nubia to the south to perhaps as far as the Euphrates in the north. We must of course read it with a grain of salt, as he would have no doubt taken great care in glorifying his pharaoh and his role in the campaigns. Still, the autobiography fits the general course of events and seems to mostly correlate with the historical events it covers. After making offerings to the gods, most importantly to Amun-Ra, Ahmose marched north. Nobody knew at that point that ahead lay more than 15 years of war and conquest, which would take Ahmose and his army to the gates of Avaris and beyond, conquering every city and defeating every force on their path. The first major city to fall to Ahmose was Memphis. His father and brother both had victories and both had captured cities, but none of their achievements rivaled that of liberating Memphis. The old capital was a shadow of the city it was in its glory days, but its capture still held immense importance. It was also important strategically, as Memphis lay close to the point from which the Nile spreads to form the delta, meaning that now Ahmose controlled all of Upper Egypt and controlled the entrance to the many branches which formed the delta, giving him an option to attack at any direction he wished, while making it far more difficult for the Hyksos to sail up the Nile and attack him. Regarding siege tactics, the Theban army had no catapults or ballistas, only ladders and some basic siege towers. Its siege strategy was a very basic one: to completely envelop a city, cut it off of supplies, and assault whenever possible. And just let me say, that it's easier said than done. Although the records dating to that period, including those of Ahmose Ibana, probably contain political propaganda, we can conclude that Ahmose was not the idle king that stayed back at the palace while his armies did all the dirty work. Although he probably didn't fight, he was there on the front, campaigning with his men, taking part in the planning, sleeping in the camp, handing out awards and decorations to his soldiers, and providing the morale of seeing their god-king on the battlefield. After Memphis, Avaris was now the target of Ahmose. The obvious choice would have been to march straight at it, as the Hyksos were now deprived of their southern vassals, and he now controlled all access points from the south. He would, however, pursue another course. You see, despite the fact that the center of the Hyksos realm was now in Egypt, they still controlled territory and had allies in Canaan, from where they would have brought reinforcements and supplies. The siege technology available to the Egyptians was not that advanced, and the siege of Avaris would be lengthy and hard to maintain properly, if its northern and eastern approaches would not be firmly secured. And so, Ahmose marched with his army northeast, towards the city of Ono, whose more famous Greek name is Heliopolis. Ono was a major town, in both size, and in that it housed the ancient temple known as the Great House, a great temple dedicated to the god Amun-Ra. After Heliopolis, Ahmose seems to have continued his march north, with little difficulty, until reaching the town of Jaru, close to the Mediterranean coast, completely blocking the land route from Egypt to Canaan. Personally, whenever I read about any battle or specific moment for any general or conqueror, think about what must have gone in their head at certain moments. One such moment is this. What went on in Ahmose's head at that moment? Here he is, 3 years into his campaign, so close to the final step of the war his father had started so many years ago, for which he paid with his life. So close to liberating Egypt and its people, fulfilling his sacred duty as the god king. Just one obstacle lay in his way. Avaris. What went on in his head at that moment? Avaris was the capital of the Hyksos. It lay on the Nile at the northeastern part of the delta. It was heavily fortified and prepared for an assault. The Hyksos didn't just sit idle all these years. They watched Ahmose and knew that the attack was coming. We know that the Hyksos introduced innovations in fortifications and that the city had a formidable citadel. It was also their capital, which meant that the Hyksos defenders would fight ferociously. It seems that it took another year or two of preparation, and perhaps to encircle and envelop it, in order to isolate it completely. It is here that Ahmose Ibana's account provides a precious first-hand account of the siege. When the town of Avaris was besieged, I fought bravely on foot, in his majesty's presence. Thereupon, I was appointed to the ship Chaya Menefer. Then, there was fighting in the water of Avaris. I made the seizure and carried off a hand. That is, he took a hand as a trophy from a fallen enemy. When it was reported to the Royal Herald, the gold of valor was given to me. Then they fought again in this place. I again made a seizure there and carried off a hand. Then I was given the gold of valor once again. Then there was fighting in Egypt to the south of this town, and I carried off a man as a living captive. I went down into the water, for he was captured on the city side, and crossed the water carrying him. When it was reported to the Royal Herald, I was rewarded with gold once more. Then Avaris was despoiled, and I brought spoil from there. One man, 3 women, total 4 persons. His Majesty gave them to me as slaves. End quote. From this account we learn many things. First of all, and something that amused me, even then, men had the urge to name their ships. More than 3,000 years ago, and men were giving names to their stuff. Second, here we have a definite proof that the assaults on the mostly riverside cities of Egypt were both amphibious and from the land. This probably means that the Theban army would probably wait for the water levels of the Nile to rise in order to better attack the walls. Third, that the siege had to be halted for a while due to events in the south. It seems that a rebellion arose in the south, by previous vassals of the Hyksos. These, however, were decisively put down by forces led by the Queen Regent herself, with reinforcements from Ahmose in the north. Ahmose himself seems to have kept the siege on Avaris until he could finally focus solely on taking it. We don't have a clear timeline, but it seems that Avaris finally fell to Ahmose's army around 1536 BC, after a ferocious siege that lasted some months. The Hyksos as a political and cultural force in Egypt were destroyed, with the remnant fleeing to the Sinai and Canaan. Despite it being a lengthy and costly siege, and despite Ahmose Ibana's account, no evidence were found to indicate large-scale looting or destruction. Ahmose would follow up on this victory with an attack across the north of the Sinai Peninsula, taking the last major holdout of the Hyksos, a town called Sharuhen, close to modern-day Gaza. This siege wasn't the walk in the park one would expect. Sharuhen was close to the Hyksos' native country. It was well fortified and supplied, and was far away from Thebes. It took 3 years of siege to finally take this last stronghold. Ahmose had finally fulfilled his destiny. He had avenged his father and finished his and his brother's war. Egypt was finally free and united. The king of Lower Egypt and Upper Egypt finally controlled the two lands. This point marked the end of the Second Intermediate Period. Ahmose would go on to be considered as the founder of a new dynasty, the 18th Dynasty, that would usher in a new period of Egyptian history, the New Kingdom. The capital of this kingdom was, of course, Thebes. Starting from Ahmose's reign, Thebes would not be just a political center, but from now on, a religious center. The famous Karnak Temple complex, constructed during the Middle Kingdom, would from now on be expanded and upgraded by the kings of the New Kingdom to become the religious center of Egypt, dedicated to Amun-Ra, and eventually surpassing the aforementioned Great Temple of Unu. Ahmose was now around 31 years old, his prime by the standards of the day. As we will see again and again, what could a successful conqueror with a loyal, veteran army possibly want after completing a successful conquest? Well, it's usually more conquest. The first target was Canaan. His main goal doesn't seem to have been conquest, but rather to mop up the remnant of the Hyksos and their influence, and show those Canaanites who was the new top dog. Another reason was economical, to reopen the trade routes with Canaan to the new kingdom. This campaign is not well documented, as it seems our hero, Ahmose Ibana, didn't take part in it. The farthest point reached by Ahmose was Byblos, in modern-day Lebanon. And although that area wasn't conquered, southern Canaan and the Sinai were now under Egyptian control. After the Canaanites, the next target would be the Nubians. The Thebans saw themselves as the heirs of the old kingdoms, and did not forget the Nubians' attack on Egypt during the intermediate period, their occupation of Egyptian fortresses, and their alliance with the Hyksos. This campaign is better documented. It seems to have taken place around Ahmose's 22nd year of reign, which means he was around 32. During this campaign, a rebellion of Nubians, led by a native Egyptian named Titian, also erupted and was also crushed. Again, we have Ahmose Ibana to thank for his account of the campaign. Then Ata, a Nubian king, came to the south. His fate brought on his doom. The gods of Upper Egypt grasped him. He was found by His Majesty at Tent Taha. His Majesty carried him off as a living captive, and all his people as booty. I brought two young warriors as captives from the ship of Ata. Then I was given 5 persons and portions of land amounting to 5 arura in my town. The same was done for the whole crew. Then came a foe named Titian. He had gathered the malcontents for himself. His Majesty slew him. His troop was wiped out. Then I was given 3 persons and 5 arura of land in my town. End quote. Ahmose established the borders of his realm at the second cataract of the Nile, while the areas to the south were turned to vassals. A new administrative center was established at Buhin. Along with establishing the largest kingdom in Egypt's history, Ahmose also attended to internal matters. His reform extended to all aspects of Egyptian society. A new professional civil service was established in response to the increase in demand for scribes and the literate. Construction programs were launched on a scale not seen since the heyday of the Middle Kingdom, especially in the Karnak complex, as evident by the portrayals of the king on the temple walls. And of course, with the construction spree came a demand for art and artists, who would again flourish in the golden age to come. Economically, all the aforementioned wars cost gold. The expansion of the state and the new apparatus it required cost gold. The new temples and their priests cost gold. Ahmose had to replenish the state's coffers. This was achieved through multiple methods. The good old method of sacking your enemy cities, especially in Nubia and Canaan, came in handy. New sources of wealth were now available to the king, as with the Delta and Nubia under Egyptian control once more, access was gained to resources not available in Upper Egypt. Gold and silver from Nubia, lapis from distant parts of Central Asia, cedar from Byblos, and turquoise from mines in the Sinai. Lastly, trade was encouraged with routes established with Canaan, Nubia, the Minoans in Crete, and more. I will also mention that only during the New Kingdom did the use of the title Pharaoh become widespread. After a glorious reign, Ahmose still had what is perhaps the most pressing matter for an Egyptian ruler, the afterlife. Ahmose had to prepare himself for his afterlife. And Ahmose made sure that he would depart this life for the afterlife with style. The last royal mortuary complex with a pyramid was constructed at Abydos. Although a debate still exists as to whether Ahmose was interred in the pyramid, if it was his intention to be interred in the pyramid, or if it was a mere cenotaph. Although only ruins of it remain today, its scale and the scale of the complex serve as a testament to the glorious journey of the great liberator to the afterlife and to the mighty realm he established. Ahmose died around 1525 BC, aged 35, and was succeeded by his son Amenhotep I. Although this age sounds young to us, that was close to the average life expectancy of that time. And keep in mind, we're talking of a king here, who lived a pretty good life. Under Ahmose's heirs, the kingdom would go on to enjoy a level of prosperity and wealth never seen before in Egypt. And unlike previous dynasties, controlling just Egypt would no longer be enough. From now on, all of them would seek the image of the warrior pharaoh, the pharaoh who led his armies, expanded Egypt's territory, and crushed its enemies. But all that wouldn't have come to pass had it not been for Ahmose, the liberator of Egypt. Join us next time for the story of Thutmose III, the Napoleon of Egypt.